with his trusty Motegootsy Lamans as his companion, Chris Donaldson set out to explore the world, leaving behind a city torn apart by sectarian violence. As he travels across Europe, Asia, and the Americas, he encounters a cast of characters that will change his life forever. This morning, he is going to share his amazing journey and how the lessons he learned will both motivate you and inspire you as well.
Have you ever felt like giving up, quitting, throwing in the towel? Welcome to Never Ever Give Up Hope, featuring Carol Graham. She's an author, health coach, and motivational speaker. Backed into a corner multiple times in her life, Carol shares with you stories on how she overcame some of the toughest obstacles a person can go through in life, but refused to give up hope. Rather than admit defeat, an opportunity was presented, and it involves each and every one of you. Carol will feature spectacular guests who will share their messages of hope, encouragement, and their inspiration to prove why life's adversities only make you stronger. And now, welcoming the host of the show, here's Carol Graham.
With me today is Chris Donaldson. Good morning or afternoon, or in your case, evening.
Good evening from Belfast, Carol. How are you?
We're doing very well, thank you. And you are recording today from Belfast, correct?
That's right.
And it's pretty cold. It's that time of year, is it?
That time of year. Most of the time of year it's cold here.
Oh, there you go. Oh dear, I don't know.
But don't start me. Don't start me.
All right, so tell us first of all, we have a lot to talk about today, and I'm anxious to hear your story. It's one that is definitely inspiring and challenging. Start from the beginning, your growing up years, etc. What made you who you are?
Well, going way back in time, I'm 65 now, so I grew up in the 70s in Belfast, and Belfast wasn't the most sublime place to live in those days. There was troubles, as we call it, bombs going off and people getting shot pretty regularly. I went to school in the center of town. And it was pretty grim at times. The windows would be all taped up to sell the tape stop and blowing in any bombs going off nearby. My father's furniture shop was a few hundred yards down the road and it got blown up regularly. Furniture shop seemed to be a particular favorite for the IRA for some reason. Yeah, I mean, I didn't have an awful, a lot of people had a lot worse time than I did, but it wasn't a great place to live up, to grow up. There wasn't much to do. You know, those things were closed. The city center would have been closed after 7 o'clock at night. Everybody went back to their own areas.
So how long did that period last?
It started in 69 sort of thing, and it went on really until about 99, I think. It was
wow.
A Good Friday Agreement signed. So
wow.
Basically most of my early adult, growing up in adult life was, didn't know anything better. And the funny thing is when you're a kid, you don't know anything better. You just,
right.
What you get is what you think is normal. So it's only when you get a wee bit older, you realize you look over your shoulder, watch TV and read books and think, well, the rest of the world isn't all like this. So there must be something else to see out there, you know. But really when you're sort of 10 or 15, you just, it's put up with what's going on as being normal. You know, have a good enough time. Whether you're, I mean, it was a fairly middle class upbringing, so it wasn't as bad as some of the areas were. It had been quite badly damaged, and so stuff happening every night, people getting thrown out of their homes and so on. So it wasn't as bad as some, but it was not a great place to grow up, really.
Was it tense? Like, could you feel the tension? Like, was there fear, you know, did people live that way?
Certainly a lot of people did. I don't ever remember feeling particularly tense or fearful because I think because you just, when you get used to a situation, you become, I wouldn't say blasé about it, but you do, it does become a norm. So you get used to stopped by police and army checkpoints, people pointing guns at you as being a fairly normal situation. Whereas your friends would come over from England or wherever, and I'd be horrified at what was going on, but it was just every day-to-day life for us, you know? So, yeah, I got to the age of 15, so I realized there must be more to life than this. So I decided I wanted to go to Australia. Most of my mates were wanting to get out of town at some stage once they finished their education. I just bought a motorbike, and I read a story about a girl who was riding around the world on the same model of motorbike I had. So I decided that'd be a great way to get to Australia. From then on until I was with, I finished university at 21, that was my plan, was to head to Australia on a on my motorbike. I wanted to see a bit of the world on the way rather than just flying there. So just about, I think it was November, October 79, I left home from Belfast and got as far as London. And those that are old enough will remember that it was just the beginning of November 79 that the Iranian Revolution happened, and the Ayatollah took over the American embassy in Tehran, which is an awful nuisance for those people, but it was a pain in the butt for me as well, because it stopped my journey to Australia after sort of so many years of planning. All of a sudden I got left home and I couldn't had nowhere to go. You know when you're going on a journey or travel adventure that things are going to go wrong, but I didn't quite expect it to go wrong quite so quickly.
Oh my goodness, what happened?
A couple of days after I left home, you know. So I was basically left with, I had to get out of Europe, it was getting cold. I didn't want to go home after a week, so it had been too much to go back to my mates, to leave to go around the world and come back a week later saying I only got as far as London. And obviously in those days there was no internet, no online information, so the only information you got was from guidebooks and stuff like that, and all my guidebooks were for Asia and the Far East, and nothing for Africa, and I had really no idea where I was going. So I travelled down Europe, down to Athens, took a boat over to Israel, and my innocence thinking I could just drive across the border into Egypt from there, which was a ceasefire. There was a ceasefire. I couldn't get over the border, couldn't get out of Israel. Had to go back to Cyprus and into Syria, which was dodgy, and through the Middle East and into Egypt.
How long did that take you?
That took a couple of months, I suppose, to work my way out of Europe. And then I went down across the Sahara, through Uganda and down to South Africa in the middle of apartheid. And one of the problems at the time was one of the things that made the trip really was my lack, my ignorance really of all things African, all things Middle Eastern, because it was great in a way, because if I'd known what I was going to face, I would never have gone. So innocence is bliss in a way, because of not knowing what I was going to face meant I continued on with the journey. But there was all sorts of hardships that I should have shouldn't have even attempted, like riding across the desert on an Italian cafe racing motorcycle, which is a bit like taking a Ferrari towing a caravan across the desert, you know, for those who aren't bikers. It's the wrong bike for the wrong place, but it, you know, I got over it and kept going. That was just one of the trials and tribulations I faced. Africa in those days is certainly very backward compared to even now. Things just didn't work. There's no petrol in places. The roads were falling apart. A certain amount of danger from the it wasn't far away. Colonies were within the living memory of most people, so the white faces weren't terribly welcome in a lot of places. So I'll just go on. Probably the hardest place to cross was Sudan, because as I say, in the north there was a Sahara Desert, but even further south there was no roads, and I had to travel, I think, 600 or 700 miles with carrying all the petrol that I needed on dirt roads that were like farm tracks, through villages with just literally people, bows and spears, beside the road. So it was quite a sort of cultural shock for somebody like myself.
So what made you keep going?
Well, at that stage, I had no choice, because I didn't want to go across the desert. The desert was a sort of this enormous barrier. Once I got across south of the desert, I had to keep going because I couldn't get back over it again. I didn't want to cross it again. Just lucky
good
to be allowed
point.
Crossing it once. So it was very much at stage of no going back once you cross that divide. But it did teach me that you did got to keep going. If you're traveling on your own, it's different when you're traveling with somebody else or a group. You've always got somebody to fall back on. But if you're traveling on your own, you very quickly realize that there's only yourself to get you. You've got yourself into the situation, and there's only yourself to get yourself out of it again. And especially when situations I was coming up against were, as I say, totally unknown to me, because I didn't even have a guidebook of what was. I didn't even know what was the next country was. In fact, at one stage, I drove off the edge of my map between Sudan and Uganda until I met a guy coming up the other way, and I was able to swap maps with him to see what the next country was. Another ancient history lesson was that Idi Amin was just coming out of Uganda at that stage. They'd just been deposed. I mean, in Sudan, if you can imagine, in Sudan, we're going to the embassy to ask them for what the situation is south. On the road south, and all they could say was don't go there. But you couldn't go west, you couldn't go north, you couldn't go east, so it was the only place to go. And again, as I say, you do, when I think back at what sort of situations I got myself into now, it's sort of pretty horrified, but as when you're going from sort of one stage to another and situations unfold, you do get used to them, and what to one person seems horrifying is becomes quite normal just to see kids with guns pointing at you at the side of the road.
Was that whole trip pretty fearful, or did you really enjoy it as an adventure?
Well, somebody said to me that a definition of an adventure is something which is pretty horrible at the time, but you can think back fondly when you're sitting in a pub with a pint in front of you.
That's a perfect answer.
Pretty true. Pretty true. So, yeah, it was pretty grim at the time. It was times of thinking, what on earth am I doing here? Only much stronger words, stronger put than that. But as I say, you just got to keep going sometimes.
So you made it, and then what happened?
Well, I got as far as Cape Town in South Africa. As I say, apartheid was in the middle of what was going on at that time, so I was quite cut off. And then running out of money, but I managed to get a position on a sailing boat in a yacht race going back to Europe, which was a feat in itself because I had very little sailing experience apart from dinghies. Never been out of sight of land, certainly. And the yacht race, you know, these are sort of Formula One version of yachts, where it took about 5 weeks to get back to Europe, racing the whole way. And the sponsor for the race was a shipping company, so they shipped my bike to the States. And at this stage, I'd realized that I wasn't really traveling to Australia at all. I'd forgotten all about it. I was really just traveling for the sake of traveling, which was very sort of good for clearing a mind that you're just living by the day rather than, you know, it's quite unusual in today's life that you, every time we get up in the morning, we plan what we're doing this week, next week, next year sort of thing. Whereas all I was worried about was happening this afternoon, where I was going to, wasn't even thinking, worrying about where I was going to sleep tonight. I was just traveling like a hobo, I suppose, is one of a better word. But it was quite clarifying to for your mind just to be able to think as short term as that and live by the day.
So you made it to the States?
Made the States, yeah. The bike was a bit of a heap. I haven't gone through Africa, so we went up to your part of the world, up to Seattle, and then up to Vancouver, drove across Canada, and decided, well, the only place to go now is South America. So I stopped in the States, worked for a bit, replenished the coffers. I mean, really, money was my biggest issue, I suppose, at this stage in the game, because I left for a four-month trip, and at this stage I was away for about a year or so. So everything was penny-pinching, apart from the motorbike had to get the petrol and oil and everything else it had to have. But I was very much the second thought, what was left of the money for every day. Eventually made it down to Argentina, called hepatitis on the way down, and a year and a half later, decided I had enough, came home and started back into normal life. I had started writing a journal and with an idea of writing a book, but I gave it up shortly after that because somebody else wrote a book, something similar, and I thought, well, there's no point in two people writing a book about riding around the world on a motorbike. Without realizing that he was a 45-year-old journalist and I was a 21-year-old, so my book was even completely different from his.
So before we talk about that, your book, I would like to ask you about on your return trip from South America. As you said, you joined the family furniture shop in Belfast. So tell us about that, which over the years you expanded into London and Dublin. And you were also the UK master franchiser for a fitness company. So we want to hear about that. You developed a health and fitness franchise and a mobile app in Dubai, where you live for 8 years with your family on a 47-foot yacht. So that's a lot.
That's
So
right.
tell us that story
Well,
first.
there's more and there's more. I suppose I got back. It was a bit messed up. If you're living on your own for a year and a half, traveling, as I say, and around the world, it sort of messes with your head a bit. I've spoken to other people who've done something similar. It sort of takes you a while to for normal life to resume, and you either have to fit in or fit out, get into. So I decided to get my head down and work in the business and develop it as best I could. And you wouldn't have thought that traveling around the world on a motorbike would give you life experiences that would be useful in business. But over the reflection, looking back on many of the things I've done them because of sort of experiences I've had to make me able to me to keep going and go in a different direction than most of my friends and most of my associates have. But yes, yeah, family business was an old family furniture shop. It's a local furniture shop, if you like. So I opened in the 80s. There was still a lot of trouble in Belfast. So I opened a shop in Dublin, really. I suppose in case our place in Belfast had been blown up several times. So it was
Oh, my word.
kind of a second property, a second business to fall back on if it needed to. But that went well, and eventually opened another shop in London. I suppose I've come around about the end of the last century, 2000-ish, realized that properties were probably business, properties were a better way of doing business, so let the franchise the furniture shops out and kept the properties, which is all very well until the property crash in 2010, whenever the banks took over the properties, any properties that were worth anything. So all of a sudden, after 30 years of working, found myself pretty much destitute without anything at all apart from the clothes in my back and a few bits and pieces. So I decided a new start. We moved to Dubai and started a mobile app company there, just the beginning of the app revolution, which was a total change of direction, not being intellectual or IT minded at all. But it was fine. I was able to use my sales and marketing background to make businesses' apps that work for them by because somebody else did the IT side of things. And at the same time, I was learned how to litigate and sue the banks to get my properties back again, which I did after about 5 years. I got most of my properties back again from them. And there's plenty of times during that process that I was back to the wall, wondering where do we go next. The banks were owned by the British government. British government pays this lawyer, pays the judges, and pays the solicitor, the whole system. You can't afford to have a legal representation yourself, so you're up against a monster without any background of knowledge or experience to fight them with. But as I say, by luck more than anything else, I was able to catch them out in a few things and eventually been able to sue them and get some properties back and some finances back. But it's still going on. It's still after 15 years.
Really?
There's still stuff going on, a fight back against them. But that's basically because I'm a stubborn old git who doesn't want to let them away with it. Even though I got my properties back, they did spoil the. I suppose what should have been the most profitable years of my business life, I should have been building and preparing myself for old age financially. But instead of that, I had to firefight to stop the banks basically stealing my business.
Well, you certainly never gave up. That's been evident. And I appreciate that. We're
Yeah,
going to
my
take.
wife said something similar and the same laugh afterwards.
Oh, that's funny. Okay.
She would call it stubbornness.
Oh, okay. Yeah, oh, that's another word. That, yeah, okay. That's the wife. I could see that, of course. Well, we're going to take a quick few second break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about your memoir, Going the Wrong Way. So we'll be right back.
Carol Graham would like to show you the path from misery to miraculous triumph in her fast-paced memoir, Battered Hope. She relates her determination to succeed as someone who experienced one horrendous nightmare after another. Gang raped and left for dead, loss of a child, husband falsely imprisoned, and cancer. Nothing could break her tenacity or faith. No matter what you face, heartache, loss, suffering, or injustice, Carol will illustrate how she became a victor the same way you can. The secret is to never, ever give up hope. Order your copy at Amazon or batteredhope.blogspot.com.
Chris Donaldson is with me today, and he's been sharing many of his exploits that he had traveling around the world. Some of the places that he mentioned, I made a mental note because I have been there, and it's always nice to see or hear someone from say things about wherever they've been from a different perspective than your own. So I thank you for that, Chris, and I'm sure that the audience will relate to many of that as well. But also, your tenacity is what speaks. And as you mentioned earlier, your wife calls it stubbornness, but you didn't give up and you kept going and you accomplished a lot. And I thank you for sharing that with us as well. So now I want you to share your memoir. Going the Wrong Way is not just a travel memoir. It is a story about finding yourself in the midst of chaos and about the transformative power of travel. I like the way you worded that. And as Chris navigates the challenges and joys of the open road, I'm sure there have been many, he learns important lessons about perseverance, friendship, and the importance of following one's dream. So address that, would you please, as you share your book with us.
Certainly. Well, I suppose one of the most unusual thing about my book was it took me 40 years to write it. I started when I was about 22 and then gave up, put it in a drawer and picked it up again when I was 60. So it was quite novel, quite a refreshing to be able to read my sort of young man's thoughts, and words and processes with my years of experience under my belt now and write about it with that sort of extra layer of hopefully knowledge on top of it. Started off as I must get this done just for future prosperity, but it was quite an emotional roller coaster for me as well, because there's things that happen to you when you're in your 20s, 40 years ago, you sort of forget about them. There's a whole mist of time and red wine and social life and working. It all just gets fogged up in the background, but it's all in your brain somewhere. And it's amazing when you read back in an old diary and look at old photographs and start writing about them, how the memories are all in there and it all comes sort of tumbling back again.
Right.
Maybe not word for word, but you know, you can remember what you were feeling, you're experiencing at the time. I enjoyed writing the book, although that was another learning experience for me, because at school it was never what you would call academic. I could never spell it, saved my life. There's lots of people got spell checker now, which I didn't have in those days. So first of all, I had to learn how to write a book before you could write a book. You can't just go straight into it. But
good point.
I did a couple of online courses. But there's one thing that proves is that people say everybody's got a book in them. But if I can write a book, and it's been on the best-selling list on Amazon for quite a few times, if I can do it, anybody can do it, really, because it's, I say, I was not born intellect. But no, the book covers it's called Going the Wrong Way, because obviously I ended up in, left for Australia and ended up in Argentina. So you can't get much more wrong than that. Geographically anyway. But it is when I started writing, I realized that going the wrong way is sort of what I've done for a lot of things in my life. I've gone the road less traveled, for instance, is a more trendy word for it. You can go down and follow the path that most people follow. which is usually easier and well drawn.
Right, right.
Less problems on it. Or else you can go the other direction and have a lot more fun. You will, won't make so much money and you won't have, you'll have a harder time. But you know, that would be more exciting and much more, if you want to get more out of life, it's certainly the way to go as far as I'm concerned. Life, you know, Western civilization is the last 50 years or so, it seems to be everybody's government spend their time trying to make things as boring as possible, health and safety, and everything else has taken grip, taken over completely. It's just no fun in life anymore. The things we used to do when we were kids, the number of things you used to do that you're not allowed to do anymore, you know, every year there's new laws coming out, new things to say, you can't do this, you can't do that.
Right.
Which I prefer to ignore as much as possible. And as I say, I've got in trouble plenty of times because of it, but hopefully we usually got out of them again with an experience or a story to tell, you know. But yeah, the book, it's not just about motorcycle trip, it's a sort of coming of age story, I suppose. I hadn't realized at the time. It's only in reflection you look back and say, well, yeah, I started that trip as a boy and ended up learning a lot of experience coming out as a man, and was the journey that made me the person I am today and gave me the skills that I've been able to use to get through life.
And what would be a highlight, do you think, of the book that would really appeal to others?
Well, there's different areas of it. I mean, there's a big motorcycle readership, like the story from the bike point of view. But as I say, there is growing up and just coming to terms with what's happening in your life and how things change and how you can improve yourself by being on your own, I think, as much as anything else. If you're with people all the time, again, in your day-to-day, most people, your work, you're with your family, you're on a bus or with your friends, going out for a drink, whatever. There's always people about you in your life, most people's lives. It's only when you're going on your own, turning up in a town or a city or village without knowing anybody at all, you have no choice but to either sit on your own or go out and meet people. But it also gives you time to reflect and discover yourself, I suppose. And I think that's one of the things that people enjoy about it.
I would think, too, that it is a real inspiration to taking on any challenge and seeing it through.
Yeah, I mean, some of the reviews that I've had on Amazon have been tremendous. People have, as you say, been inspired. Armchair travelers, as they call themselves, have been inspired to get up and do it. And I suppose one of the things that I've really sort of promoted is to get up and do it. In fact, one of the whenever I published a book a few years ago, one of my friends said to me, "You never actually got to Australia. Why not have another go?"
What do you think of that?
Well, I couldn't turn it down, could I? So I still had the same motorbike. I kept it over the years, so I thought I'll have to take my old motorcycle to the mound. So 2 years ago, two of us left on route to Australia.
Oh, my word.
We both have jobs and families, so we did it in 2 week legs and drove for 2 weeks and left the bikes where we were and I flew back home, went back to work for 2 months and then flew out again 2 or 3 months later.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
So I was able to recreate the journey that I never took. Unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, the guy who talked me into doing it gave up after the second leg. So I ended up unintentionally doing that on my own as well. So I finally got to Iran, finally saw the American embassy in Tehran, which is still all boarded up, same as it was in 1979. And drove across Pakistan into India and Nepal, and then flew the bike to Australia, or flew out to meet it last year, and finally got to see the Golden Gate, see the Sydney Opera House and the Harbour Bridge, and finally get to Australia. So it was a 43-year journey completed finally.
In any journeys and up and coming?
It's like a love affair. Once you've finished, the best way of getting over one finishing is to start another one. So the bike's now in Melbourne, Australia. So I hope to go out and pick it up and finish the journey by taking it around the world, by taking it to West Coast America, and driving across the States, seeing a few old buddies on the way, and then bringing it back to Europe.
And when do you plan on doing that?
Hopefully this year, if we can get back together. As I say, I'm 65 now. I've got a bit more time in my hands, a bit more money than I had when I was 21, but I still got families, I've got kids at school, stuff like that. So it's a matter of, there's always any of these things, there's never an easy way of doing it. There's always some reason that you shouldn't do it,
mm-hmm.
whether it's safety, whether it's your family telling you not to do it, whether it's time or money. But if you put your mind to it, there's always a way to get around these things. As I say, we didn't have time to take 3 months off our lives to go to Australia in one go, so we did it in six goes. So there's always a way to do these things if you sit down. If the problem there, 99% of the time, the problem is just something that needs to be solved.
As I mentioned earlier, this has definitely been inspiring, and I think also created the desire to step out. So inspiring beyond just a feel-good, but motivating to step out, to do the exploits that you always wanted to do, not hold back. And I think your testimony too, you're never too old to do it. And you're still a young man. You've got lots more journeys in you. So,
Well, I don't go quite so fast or quite so far.
Right, of course, of course.
I don't go out and party after a hard day's drive anymore. I just go to bed with a cup of cocoa.
Oh, there you go. Okay, well, again, this has been very, very interesting. As I mentioned, I did relate to some of the things that you were sharing about the places that you went, and I'm sure the audience will as well. Is there anything you would like to add just in conclusion?
Well, just on your motivation and suicide of things, it's to get people off their butts to do things.
I think
people tend to overthink situations too much these days. Spend too much time thinking about reasons not to do something rather than thinking of the reasons that they should do them. And sometimes you're better just not thinking about it at all, just going and doing it. But just don't come back to me and give off when it all goes wrong for you.
Yeah. I like that. That's really good. Say that again. Don't dwell on the reasons why not to do it, but...
Think about why you should do it.
Think about why you should do it. Excellent. Excellent place to stop. And thank you again, Chris, for being on Never Ever Give Up Hope. I look forward to your book. I look forward to sharing, and I'm sure the audience will appreciate your story.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Never Ever Give Up Hope, featuring Carol Graham. Did you know that most people succeed because they are determined to? Quitting was never an option. Carol loves your comments and will respond to each one. So please subscribe and review this podcast. A rating of 5 stars would be outstanding and appreciated. Remember, if you are still here, there is always hope.